Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we'll continue our peace-building series with Chad Ford. He's author of Dangerous Love, and his new book is 70 Times 7, Jesus' Path to Conflict Transformation. As a professor of peace-building, conflict mediator, and a follower of Jesus, Chad Ford offers perspectives on how to avoid or reconcile contention when life's inevitable disagreements arise. Chad Ford is an associate professor of religious studies. He's on the faculty advisory board of the Haravi Peace Institute at Utah State University, and he specializes in intercultural and religious peace building. His work as a peace educator, conflict mediator, and facilitator has frequently taken him into conflict zones around the world. He's made more than 50 trips to the Middle East. He's worked as a mediator and facilitator on numerous other conflicts around the world in Ireland, Cyprus, South Africa, New Zealand, Australia, Oceania, China, and through the United States. He also sits on the executive board of the nonprofit Peace Players. Chad Ford, thanks for coming back in.
Thanks for having me back, Tom.
So this is, I guess, typical Cache Valley spring. You've lived many years in Hawaii, so this is, it's got to be fun, in quotes, for
yeah,
you.
I hear we get tricked here. Last week, I'm like, oh, spring has come, and then it was hailing on our heads yesterday.
Right. So just briefly, you have a sports background. Tell me a little bit about that.
I do. When I was in law school at Georgetown, I started a sports internet company called SportsTalk.com with a friend of mine, Jason Peary. And ESPN bought that in 2001. And from 2001 until about 2005, I was an NBA writer, editor, reporter for ESPN.com. And then I took a job at BYU Hawaii and stayed on doing the draft until 2018. So almost 20 years of working on the NBA and NBA draft with ESPN.
So we were talking before we went on the air. Your bracket's still alive for March Madness.
My bracket's doing great this year, but historically mine are terrible. I've never won a March Madness bracket before.
Yeah.
Maybe this is the year.
It never happens, but I guess we could have predicted successfully at the beginning of the tournament to have success that all the number one seeds would make the Final Four. But it almost never happens.
I think 2008 was the last year, right? So your odds are against you doing that. But this year I've got Duke and Florida playing in the final with Duke winning it all, and
yeah.
That's my path to finally winning this bracket.
And that's still alive.
It's still alive.
We'll see. We're also talking before we're on the air as well about the conflicts around the world. I just read your bio. You've worked in many areas, more than 50 trips to the Middle East. Tell me what's going on now. We were talking about USAID.
Yeah, I was just there in February, and It's a difficult time. Obviously, there's been over 500 days of war between Israel and Hamas, with a few brief ceasefires that unfortunately have broken down again. But I was there during that brief window of the ceasefire with a number of peace nonprofits, typically ones that work with Israelis and Palestinians, gathering together to have conversations about how they work together, how they align, how they continue the work. Because it's, as you can imagine, Tom, it's been devastating, right? This war has pulled many, many people who have been involved in the peace process away from that process, just to say this is a line too far, both on the Israeli and the Palestinian side. And you have people who just don't want to associate with that right now. And just people that are traumatized by the extent of the conflict, which has been the worst in decades, right in Israel. So you know, coming out in the ceasefire, you start having people basically coming out of the bunker, if you will, and trying to start thinking about what would it look like for us to live together and work together. And in the midst of all that, the United States' decision to at first pause and then I think end USAID spending has had a dramatic effect because so many of these organizations were funded by USAID or by the U.S. State Department. They're nonprofit organizations. They're not for-profit organizations. It's really their only way to make money. And so this has been a double whammy, right, on the peace process. One, that 500 days of war. Now, no funding for these organizations going forward. And it's been a devastating time. And for me personally, to be with people that I've worked with for two decades, see them losing their jobs, see them questioning what they do next. It's very unpopular, by the way, to be an Israeli or a Palestinian peace builder. They're often shunned in their own communities. So there's questions about what do they do next? How do they get jobs? How do they take care of their families? And you know, as someone who's worked there and worked with USAID in the past, that I certainly don't work for them, but as a contractor and working with the U.S. State Department, it's extremely troubling to me because we're in a moment where we need peace building more than ever. We're in a moment where we need people to be stepping up and learning how to collaboratively solve problems, and the funding for that is cratered. And you know, I tell my students here at Utah State and what have you, right? These are really challenging times to do this work for a lot of reasons. But without funding, it becomes so much harder.
So what will need to happen? I guess there's always need for money, right? And I guess that maybe another source of funding will be needed. What's going to be needed? And you also said that you know, it's become less popular, obviously.
Yeah.
Tensions flare in a war.
Yeah. It's partly why I wrote this book, Tom. I obviously didn't know about what was going to happen with USAID when I started writing it. But I'm convinced that one of the answers to that question is that churches are going to have to be one of the methods that step up and step into this realm. You know, I'm a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. President Russell M. Nelson has recently given a call at the General Conference for more peacemakers within the LDS faith. You're seeing this increasingly in other denominations, whether they be Christian, Jewish, Muslim, for people to step up. And I think that one of the answers, certainly there'll be private philanthropy. There are certainly other areas of government philanthropy in the EU and other places like that. But I think churches are a great place because virtually every religion touches on peacemaking as part of its goal, right? Now, certainly people can raise their eyebrows and say, man, I think religions also get into a lot of conflict and do a lot of wars, which is certainly true. But that peacemaking element is there. And I've worked with Jews. I've worked with Muslims. I've worked with Buddhists. I've worked with Hindus. I've worked with a lot of different groups. And that peace-building narrative is there if we want to tap into it. And, of course, there have been great examples of religious peace-building in the past. And so I think that you're going to see the impetus move there. And so I hope the book is well-timed, especially for Christians and members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
One hopeful thing from the book, you say that it's in the highest conflict areas where peacemakers emerge. I guess there's a need, a higher need, but that's, it must be a human impulse. Must be some people who see a need and step forward, even at personal risk. You're saying peacemakers are shunned in some of their communities.
Yeah. I think it was Mr. Rogers that one time said, you know, when you're in trouble, look for the helpers. And one of the things that actually gives me hope is the worse the conflict, the more you actually see people start to get up, take this seriously, start figuring out what they can do to make a difference in their homes, in their communities, in their organizations. And it's a little counterintuitive, right? Because it seems like as the heat raises, right, in those conflicts, our desire is to run away. And certainly that is the most common conflict style, right, is conflict avoidance and just getting away and running away from conflict. But I'm always heartened that there are people, everyday people, doctors, nurses, school teachers, social workers, right? Police, firemen, you name it, that instead of running from the fire, they step into it. And they do it because they see suffering. And they see that if no one does anything, conflict has the potential to burn everything, you know, to the ground. And, you know, historically, we don't have to look, unfortunately, that far back, right, to see conflict in World War II, in World War I, you know, where tens of millions of people are dead. Tens of millions are injured. Infrastructure is absolutely wiped out and destroyed. I certainly don't think any of us want us to be back to those times.
So the title of the book, if you just joined us, we're talking with Chad Ford. He's Associate Professor of Religious Studies at Utah State University on the Faculty Advisory Board of the Harvey Peace Institute at USU as well. The new book is 70 times 7, Jesus's Path to Conflict Transformation. I guess let's start there, that 70 times 7, right?
Yeah.
This is a famous, I guess, saying from Jesus in the Bible.
Yeah. And I actually, if I can provide a little context, because there was some question even about calling it this and why I wanted to call it this, it actually starts to me with this conception that I hear along a lot of modern Christians, that Jesus' teachings don't really apply to our day, right? That back in Jesus' day, you know, things were calm, cool, and you could sort of focus on, you know, turning the other cheek or loving your enemy, but not in our times, not with the sort of political polarization and the sort of danger that we experience in the world. And I think it's a fundamental misunderstanding historically of what Jesus is stepping into. The Roman Empire has colonized Israel. Jews are looking for a Messiah, a military Messiah that is going to militarily deliver them from the Romans to get back their religious freedom and their economic freedom and their political freedom. And they're suffering deeply. They're angry. There's hatred that they are feeling towards the people that are mistreating them at the time. And when Jesus shows up in his hometown of Nazareth at the beginning of his ministry where he grew up, and he pulls a scroll out and speaks from Isaiah, he's reading a messianic scripture. But it's not what people expect. It's about caring for the poor. It's about caring for the brokenhearted, right? It's about delivering the captive. And he actually leaves out the very last verse of the scripture that he's quoting. So he edits it and ends out the vengeance of the Lord, right? It's the day of the vengeance of the Lord. And there's a lot of confusion in the congregation at that point about Jesus is reading this messianic scripture, but it's not like the other messianic scriptures, which talk about a Messiah that's kind of kicking butt, right? It's this Messiah that's healing. It's a Messiah that's reconciling. It's a Messiah that's bringing people together. And at the end of that story, they're so angry with him, they actually try to throw him off a cliff. Jesus, as far as I'm aware, never returns to his hometown. He never comes back to Nazareth. That's a really challenging way to start a ministry. And then as he calls his disciples and his apostles together and gives the Sermon of the Mount and the Sermon on the Plain, and he's talking about loving your enemy and turning your other cheek when someone strikes it, not being angry with your brother, leaving your religious observances and going and reconciling with a family member before you go to the temple to pray. These are all hard things. Sermon of the Mount's hard. It is incredibly hard. And Peter, I think at some point, he was always the most vocal of Jesus's disciples, always the one questioning, stumbling a little bit. He comes to Jesus, and the topic at the point time was forgiveness, and says, look, how many times are we supposed to do this, right? Like, and he suggests 7. And if I was Peter, I don't blame him, right? I mean, you know, loving your enemy, turning your other cheek. What if they don't love you back, right? What if they continue to mistreat you? And you could see Peter trying to put a limit on it. And when Jesus says 70 times 7, I think some people say, okay, it's a lot, right? Or it's, you know, do the math. That's 490 times. Seven, by the way, in Hebrew was a perfect number. And when you multiplied that number by a magnitudes of 10, or in this case, 70, right, it means infinity. And what I hear Jesus saying in that moment is, until it's done, Peter, until you're reconciled, you keep doing this, regardless of how the enemy responds, until you're reconciled. And to me, that most accurately distills the teachings of Jesus, and it most accurately distills what I face as a conflict mediator every day. People want their reconciliation to be fast. They want the other side primarily to be the one doing the reconciling, right? I want to be apologized to, not apologized for. I want people to give me justice, not have to give justice back to others. And Jesus is inviting us to do something very, very hard here, but also something that I find to be incredibly effective.
I want to read this from the book, going along with what you just said. This is from the introduction. Are there, looking for more exceptions to this, right? Are there times when it's okay to hate our enemies, to be angry with our brothers, sisters and brothers, to throw stones at those who have sinned against us or others, to withhold forgiveness, especially when the person who has hurt us is a repeat offender? I guess one of the keys is you could say it does nothing to do a unilateral surrender, right?
Yeah.
And that's what it feels like sometimes.
Yeah. You know, when I wrote Dangerous Love, I got the same question. It comes up again. I'll get through a whole workshop. I was just with the Salt Lake Interfaith Council, got through the whole presentation. I can predict with accuracy what is going to happen at the end of one of those workshops. Someone's going to raise their hand, they're going to stand up, and they're going to say, yeah, but you don't know my spouse the way I do, or you don't know my boss the way that I do, or you don't know the Democrats or the Republicans the way I do, right? In other words, this stuff works, but it doesn't work against the really bad people. And as it just turns out, the really bad people are the people that I'm in conflict with in my life. I call it the "what about Hitler" response. And the "what about Hitler" response is simply, right, I want to find a way to invalidate all of this by thinking of the worst possible person I can possibly think of and then saying, yeah, Chad, but it won't work with them. And part of that is based off of evidence that I have, right? It didn't work with Hitler, or I've tried it with my spouse, or I've tried it with my boss at work, or I've tried to reach across the aisle and have bipartisan work, and it's been rejected every time. And I think I understand the frustration, but I always sort of come back to something when I work with couples all the time. We talk about different patterns. We talk about different tools that are available in conflict, but inevitably they go right back to the patterns and rhythms that they've had their whole life. And I'll stop them in the mediation and say, okay, what we're doing right now, is that working for you? No. Is it what you've done in the past? Yeah, every time. Was it working for you then? No. So why do you think it's going to work this time, right? And that's my question, right? Given where we are in the world, given where people are in the mediations I do in their relationships, why is it that we think that continuing to follow the patterns of violence, mistreatment, domination, competition, or whatever that have not worked historically in the past are going to work this time, right? And the sad answer to so much of this is it requires a 70 times 7 level of patience, commitment, faith in the other person, and the ability to, you know, I know people don't like to hear this, suffer a little bit, because what's bigger than me or what's bigger than you is us. And we're looking for us preservation instead of self-preservation.
We'll go to break. Before we go to break, I'll just preview this. There are four parts in the book: Love Your Enemies, Rolling Away Stones, The Risk of Embrace, and The Ministry of Restoration. In each of these sections, there's some practice, some tools that you give people. So we'll get into some practical, I guess, advice Chad Ford has for us to do this harder, this dangerous love, right, that you talked about in your previous book. We're talking with Chad Ford, He is associate professor of religious studies at Utah State University. He's on the faculty advisory board of the Harari Peace Institute at Utah State University. And his new book is 70x7, Jesus's Path to Conflict Transformation. It's the latest in our peace building series. More following this. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. This is the latest today in our peace-building series. We're talking with Chad Ford. He is Associate Professor of Religious Studies and on the Faculty Advisory Board of the Harari Peace Institute at Utah State University. His previous book is Dangerous Love. His new book that we're talking about today is called 70x7, Jesus' Path to Conflict Transformation. And I'll note that Chad Ford is over on Substack. You can find him at ChadFord.substack. Your, I guess your series there is called The Waymaker.
Yeah.
So check that out. Interesting. Check out the previous book as well, Dangerous Love, and the new book, 70x7, Jesus's Path to Conflict Transformation. So I'm trying to find this here from my notes. You say that conflict is the primary source of change in our lives. It can simultaneously be a source of joy and pain, and it all depends on how you look at conflict, right, and how you approach it, is what you're saying.
Yeah. I think especially for a lot of people, they feel like if I'm in conflict, something's deeply wrong, right? Deeply wrong with a relationship, deeply wrong with me. When you get to religious communities, often conflict is termed sinful, right? So now I'm sinning that I'm in conflict. And I find that really interesting because conflict to me is necessary. It's like breathing. It's like drinking, right? Whenever I'm going to be with other people, we are not always going to agree on everything, right? And because of that, there is going to be a level of conflict. And so to me, conflict can be destructive. Of course it can be. It can destroy. And that's the sort of conflict I think that many of us are afraid of and worry about. But conflict also can be constructive as well. It can allow us to create. I think it can be very healthy. In fact, John Gottman, who does years and years of research on relationships and has an algorithm that predicts divorce with like a 90% accuracy, says that the number one predictor is when couples quit arguing. Right? Now, that's shocking to a lot of people because they think, well, that's a perfect marriage, right? Like that I don't ever argue with my spouse anymore. But it actually means that everything is being avoided. It's all being swept under the rug because you're just never going to be in a relationship with someone who always thinks, acts, and agrees with everything that you do, right? So what we need are more tools to be able to navigate conflict in constructive ways as opposed to destructive ways. And that actually starts with not avoiding conflict, right? Mm-hmm. Like I actually have to be able to step into conflict and recognize that if I don't, it will metastasize. It will turn into destructive conflict over time, even if it doesn't look that way in the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Another word, I guess, for destructive conflict would be contention.
Yeah.
Jesus did not avoid conflict, but he did condemn contention.
Yeah, exactly. And it is funny, people that say, oh, conflict is sinful. I'm like, have you read the New Testament? Jesus is in conflict almost on every page. And unless we want to now term Jesus as sinful, then we have to wrestle with what was he doing in conflict. And if you look at it, he was trying to teach. He was trying to bring people together. He was trying to get people to empathize with others. He was trying to bring about justice, but not the justice that destroys, but the justice that renews and restores and rebuilds and reconciles, right? And when people talk about this tension between mercy and justice, I don't think Jesus sees a tension because the type of justice that he's calling for into the world is not the sort of justice that's the opposite of mercy that destroys. It works hand in hand with mercy. It's forgiveness plus restoring, bringing back, giving restitution back to the people that have been hurt or harmed. And that's the sort of thing that rebuilds and it doesn't actually destroy. And so we're caught up in a lot of concepts, justice and sin and what have you, when it comes to conflict, that are just very different than the way I read Jesus navigating these sorts of issues, especially in the New Testament.
So I want to jump into these specific areas that you talk about. As an introduction, you say that we need to start practicing active peace we need instead of the passive peace we want.
Yeah.
And you talked about that, right? We want a peace that we don't have to work for, we don't have to suffer for, don't have to, sacrifice for. But that's probably not going to happen.
Yeah, we want the other side to do the work, right? And in part because I think for many of us, we feel like conflict is happening to us as opposed to we're participating in a pattern of conflict. And I've always found like this is step one when I'm working with people. When they come in, their narrative is, this is what's happening to me. It's awful. I'm suffering. The other person won't stop doing whatever it is that's causing the problem. I need your help. Help me change them, right? So that this conflict will end. And the first job that I really have is helping them recognize you're in a pattern of conflict in which you are participating, right? That's really hard to look at. And in part, it's hard to look at because we have all this justification built up about why we're right and the other side is wrong, why they need to change, why we're the victim and they're the victimizer. And look, we can certainly be victims, right? We can certainly be the person that did not start the conflict. But for conflicts to grow and to escalate, they need fuel. Right? And they need our participation. If we're not going to participate in the conflict, it is going to wither and die. So the fact that a conflict is hot, the fact that you're suffering and they're suffering is all evidence to me that you're actually participating in a conflict. And now we have to think about how do we de-escalate the conflict. And that typically, unfortunately, is going to be on us. Everybody looks for the answers as how do I get the other side to de-escalate? And I'm going to use force and threats and shame and guilt and all of those sorts of things to get you to stop. When what I really need to be looking at is what are the things that I can do that are invitational to the other person to follow my lead and actually stop the conflict.
Let me give you a yes, but I'm sure you've heard this. Takes two to tango, right?
Exactly.
What if my person on the other side, the enemy, whatever it is clearly not willing to do anything?
Yeah. Again, Tom, I think it comes right back. That's sort of Hitler question again, yeah. Right? I'm in a relationship right now, or I'm in a conflict where the other side clearly enjoys the conflict or is continuing to pursue it or has no empathy for me. I'm trying all this stuff. They're not reciprocating. And I think a couple of things to notice. Most of the time when people say, I'm trying all this stuff, they're not. Right? They're actually doing stuff that looks pretty similar to what the other side is doing. So when they say, I'm trying Jesus's way, I don't think so. And the number one thing I can point to is 70 times 7. You've done this 490 times. No, of course not. It feels like it. A lot of times for people, of course, it feels like it, but I doubt that it's that. The second thing that I notice is that it's a signal of something that's broken. When I refer to my partner, my workmate, my bishop, you know, someone from the other side is evil or Hitler or you know whatever it is, I'm already dehumanizing them to a certain extent. I've lost a sense of their humanity. And because I've lost the sense of their humanity, of course I'm going to believe that they can't change, that they can't participate in this process. Because I haven't lost it for myself, of course I believe that I would be open to those things and I'm capable of doing those things. But I've lost it for others. This is a key point that you see Jesus navigating. He sees people differently than everyone else around him. He's with prostitutes. He's with lepers. He's with the unclean. He's with tax collectors. And this is driving the religious authorities of the time crazy. But Jesus sees something with them. He sees divinity within them. He sees goodness within them. And he taps into that in every case. And what do? They drop their sins and they end up following Jesus. And I think it starts with that, right? It starts with loving your enemy. I refer to this in the book of opening the eyes of our hearts. Jesus is excellent at this. We tend to be really bad at this in conflict, and I'm never going to get into reconciliation with someone I don't see the humanity of. You know, the Quakers and Mennonites were two sort of historical Christian peace-building churches, were amazing at this, but they both come from different religious traditions and backgrounds historically, but both of them captured this point in the New Testament. They both saw something where Jesus sees people differently than we typically see people. And because he sees them that way, he's able to engage in constructive problem solving with them and actually inspire them to change. And the religious authorities at the time were the opposite. They sort of shunned them. They called them unclean. They pushed them into corners where they didn't have to see them anymore. And in many ways, the problems persisted and grew. And so Mennonites and Quakers were really the crafters of what we call Western modern mediation now. And in the process of doing so, their underlying principle was there is light within you. And my job as a mediator is to help you rediscover it and find it. And I think Jesus was great at that. I feel like that's my job a lot as a mediator, is help people rediscover that light within them and help people discover it in each other as well.
So in each of these parts of the book, part one is Love Your Enemies. You've just been talking about that. You have some practice sections. What's something we can do to practice loving our enemy?
Well, you have to start there by thinking about not just what they are doing to me, but we have to start thinking about what this conflict might be doing to them. We have to think about ways that they might be struggling or suffering right now. And this I found is a really powerful tool. People tend to experience a lot of fear in conflict. That's why we avoid conflict in the first place. We're deeply focused on what will happen to me. But if we reverse the question and ask, what are they afraid of? What are they thinking when they're asking the same question? I think there's a lot of humanity that's there. I think it's why Jesus tells this parable early on when someone comes to him and asks him, what are the greatest commandments? And he asks the prayer, he always answers with questions. He says, you know, you're learned, like you've read the scriptures, what does it say? And he says, okay, love God with all my heart, my mind, and strength, and love my neighbor as thyself. And then Jesus actually tells him, you answered this correctly, just go and do that, right? And you'll be saved. But it's human nature for someone to come back and say, this is sort of the yes, but, yes, but who's my neighbor, right? And at the time in Jesus's culture, not everybody was my neighbor, right? People who kept the same faith traditions as me, people who were ritually clean, my neighbor, lots of other groups, including Samaritans, were not. Right? They were my neighbor. And so then Jesus takes this, what, yes, but, and he drops it into a parable on the road to Jericho, which was referred to as the Bloody Pass at the time. It was this dangerous road. And he sets it up, right, with this person who's been attacked by thieves and is beaten and laying by the side of the road. And then he has a rabbi pass, and then he has a priest pass on the side of the road, and they don't stop to help him. And then this Samaritan shows up. And not only does he stop to help him, but he actually takes him to a hostel and pays for medical care. He's actually quite excessive. And then he asks the person, like, which of these people was the neighbor? And I think he begrudgingly says, yeah, you know, the guy that stopped him. And, you know, Martin Luther King did something really cool with that parable during the civil rights movement. And he said, you know, you may ask why the rabbi and the priest don't stop on the side of the road. And you can have all these different religious explanations. It's unclean. They had important ceremonies to get to. They couldn't touch blood, whatever. But he's like, I want to go back to the most basic primal reason. They were afraid. They're walking by, they see that guy beat up on the side of the road, and they say, if it could happen to him, it could happen to me. In fact, maybe those same thieves are waiting around for somebody else stupid to get off their camel, right, and go over and help. But the Samaritan reverses the question and says, what will happen to this man if I don't stop to help him? And King says, that is the question. And I think it's a super helpful question if we want to think about how do I change my heart from hating my enemy to loving my enemy? What will happen if I don't? And the answer, sadly and historically, is more conflict, more pain, more destruction, and sometimes so big that it gets out of our control.
Mm. If you just joined us, we're talking with Chad Ford. His latest book is called 70 times 7, what we can learn from Jesus about handling conflict. And we live in a very contentious age. And you said earlier in the program, Chad, that Jesus lived in a very similar time. Let's go to the next section, rolling away stones.
Yeah. Well, what do we do when we're in conflict? We blame other people. Right? And not only do we blame internally, but we go to friends and family and other people that are supportive, sort of allies, right? And tell the story, but tell it in a very carefully crafted way in which it's clear who's right and who's wrong. We throw stones, right? Because people have hurt me, as a way of defending ourselves, as a way of telling people, hey, cool, that's not okay. Sometimes, sadly, to wound the other person. I've been wounded, and so now I want you to wound back. So whether it's defensive that I throw stones, or whether it's actually aggressive and I'm actually trying to hurt you so that you can suffer a little bit like I've suffered, I'm in a conflict. Stones beget stones. They create more stones in the process, because if we throw a stone at someone after they've thrown one at us, their reaction is not going to be, well, I guess I deserved that, right? It's going to be, your stone was bigger, or you threw it harder, or I had good justification for throwing mine, but yours doesn't. And so they go out looking for more stones. And so again, we actually have this parable, right? We actually have this story with Jesus and this woman who's caught in the act of adultery, and they ask Jesus, right? She's been caught in the act, right? Should she be stoned? And I love how Jesus pauses in the story, and he's got a stick, and he's like, he's drawing in the sand. And I think it's an unexpected response before Jesus says, he that is without sin cast the first stone. And it's what's so interesting about that story is it says that the religious authorities at the time, they drop their stones, and they leave wrestling with their own conscience. And then he has this conversation with a woman and says, you know, where are your accusers? And then go thy way and sin no more. But I think people drop the story there, but that's not the end of the story. The religious authorities come back, and they're confused about all this. Like, she deserves it, right? And that's God's justice. And Jesus tells them, look, there's no life in this. Right? You misunderstand my father, right? He loves her. He loves you, right? He wants the sword of justice that redeems, not destroys. Stones destroy, right? They do not redeem. There's no life in this. And ironically, the story ends with them trying to stone Jesus right. Again at the end. That's actually how that story ends. And I see those same justifications coming up all the time. Yeah, but they deserve it. They can't get away with this, right? I'm suffering, and they're somehow benefiting right from the conflict. And we lose sight of the fact that throwing those stones is not going to bring us peace. It's not going to bring us reconciliation. It's not going to bring us the sort of justice that actually heals. It's only going to bring the sort of justice that destroys us and others. And, you know, there's a really interesting statistic of families who sadly have been victims of someone who's taken a child or taken a family member. Many of them want the death penalty, right, as a response to this horrible crime that's happened. But the research is quite telling at the end, Tom. After they get what they want, they don't feel the peace that they think that they're going to feel. They don't feel the sense of justice or redemption. It actually doubles the pain because there was no reconciliation. And so, you know, for the second one, whatever it is that I'm throwing at the other person, I have to recognize it's not protecting me. It's not doing me any good. It is not going to solve this conflict or bring me peace. It's only going to bring me more pain. Jesus rolls away stones at the end, right? At the resurrection, the stone is rolled away from the tomb. There is restoration. There is reconciliation that's offered. We have to engage in the hard task of rolling those things away and finding ways to connect and collaboratively problem solve with a person, as opposed to just doing more war.
What would you suggest, practical ways we can do that? Reach out, not throw a stone, but, you know, seek collaboration.
Forgiveness, right? Offering forgiveness is a very different and unpredictable response to a stone coming our direction. Jesus actually teaches when someone slaps you on the cheek, you don't slap them back, you give them the other cheek. And I know some people read that as passive, but I actually think it's incredibly smart, right? Because conflict requires a predictable response, right? If I slap you on the cheek, I'm bracing for you to slap me back, right? That is the predictable human response, or to run away maybe, right? If you're overwhelmed by that. For you to look at me, Tom, after I slapped you on the cheek and say, hey, Chad, it seems like you're really, really upset right now. And I don't know exactly what's going on, but if you need to get it out, here's my other cheek. Mm. It destroys my justification, right? That is not the predictable response that I would expect. You stand your ground. You treat me back with respect. You actually offer, if there's other things I need to get off my chest, to get them off at that point. And the most common response to that is to actually not hit you back. Right? But if I hit you and you hit me back, I have more justification now. I actually feel like you deserved it more. If you run away, I say, of course you ran away, right? Because you don't want to face me. I think Jesus is asking us to stand our ground, to try to understand why people are throwing rocks at us, to maybe even invite them, if they have a few more rocks left in their bag, to go ahead and throw them. But to assert with them, I have no intention of throwing something back. I have no intention of hurting you. I see you are hurting, and now what I want to think about is healing.
Well, let's take another break. We'll come back and talk about the last two parts, the risk of embrace and the ministry of restoration. We're talking with Chad Ford. His latest book is 70 times 7, Jesus' Path to Conflict Transformation. Chad Ford is Associate Professor of Religious Studies and on the Faculty Advisory Board of Harari Peace Institute at Utah State University. More following this. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. So we are continuing our peace-building series. We're talking with Chad Ford, who's Associate Professor of Religious Studies and on the Faculty Advisory Board of the Harari Peace Institute at Utah State University. Previous book is called Dangerous Love. The new book out now is, at least for pre-order, right, is 70 times 7, Jesus' Path to Conflict Transformation. And Chad Ford has four main areas of lessons we can learn from Jesus in improving our approach to conflict in our lives. So part three, the risk of embrace. Tell us about this.
Yeah, this is my favorite part, in part because if I can get to those first two steps, they're hard enough, right? But the common thing that I hear when it's time to do something, because those are more internal types of steps, is if they would just apologize, if they would just come to me, if they would just confess what they did wrong, if they would just forgive me, whatever, it's always, if they would do this, I will do B, right? If they do A, I will do B. The problem is the other side of the conflict is saying the same thing. If they would do A, I would do B. And we get stuck. We get paralyzed a lot in conflict because I'm afraid to take the first step. And so I used to do this little analogy in Dangerous Love, where I would stand back to back on the stage when I was doing workshop, and we'd be elbowing each other. And I would ask people, what does this look like? And they say, oh, it's conflict. How do you know? Well, you don't see each other, right? You're back to back and you're elbowing each other. And it seems like the harder you elbow the person, the harder they elbow you back. And then I ask people to turn first. And I say, okay, I want the other person to think about where you would move on the stage if we're back to back, to like turn first, to initiate the peace building process. And what most people do is they try to get in front of me. So we're standing face to face, right? But every time they do that, I just keep turning around. And then they start chasing me and start circles. Sometimes people actually grab me and try to hold me still, and I'll just close my eyes. And, you know, people will start laughing uncomfortably in the audience, and I'll ask them what's wrong. And there's usually a lot of confusion because it's like, oh, well, they were trying to go face to face. That's the opposite of back to back, right? They're not elbowing you anymore. Why didn't that work? And I said, you know, it's interesting that does make sense. except that a lot of times when it's face to face, what it really means is, hey, Chad, I want you to see me. And once you see me and once you quit throwing your stones, you'll recognize that you were wrong, that you owe me an apology, and the conflict will go away. So I ask people to try it again. And what most people do is they'll just turn around and stare at my back, right? Now they're seeing me. They're no longer elbowing me, so they're not throwing stones. But I still can't see them. And it's a powerful metaphor, right? Because what if they're staring at my back, the inclination is I want to turn and see them as well. The interesting thing, though, is I was at doTERRA one time, a company here in Utah, and I was up on stage and doing this. And the woman, instead of just turning and staring at my back, she actually turned around and hugged me from behind and rested her head on my shoulder. And I didn't know what to do, right? But it was intimate. It was beautiful. It felt more than staring, right? It was embrace. And, you know, Jesus tells this story, one of the most famous stories, I think, in the New Testament about this son who takes his father's inheritance, goes and blows it, is out of money, doesn't know what to do, decides that he's going to go back home, and says to himself, I'll go home. I'm no longer worthy to be this man's son, but I will be his servant. And as he's going home, the father sees him from afar off and starts running towards his son and embraces him. And the son resists at first and says, you know, Dad, I've messed up. I don't expect you to take me back as your son. I can be your servant and what have you. To which the father instead says, no, everything that I have is yours. We're going to hold this feast. Both of them actually take risk in that story that is interesting. The son comes back, first of all, like a lot of us wouldn't, right? After how much we've offended and whatever, he comes back. He's humble. He's prostrated himself to the ground. The father, without even knowing that the son has done this, without even knowing the attitude of his son, is running towards him and embracing. And you have this joyous sort of moment, right? We need to be the first person to take the risk of embrace, to open our arms, to invite people in to that embrace, to let people know that just regardless of what's happened in the past, I'm willing to re-enter into a relationship with you. And that really segues into the last one, right? The ministry of restoration. It's really clear when I was reading the New Testament again and again and again. Yes, Jesus says that he comes to reconcile us with the Father, to pay for sin so that we can return back to home. But it's also equally clear that he came to help us reconcile ourselves to each other, that his ministry was not just about the kingdom of heaven, but also ushering in the kingdom of God on earth. And that kingdom looked like a place where we loved each other, where we forgave each other, where we turned the other cheek, where we were able to collaboratively problem solve and overcome our issues. The Jesus that I read right from the New Testament was all about building those bridges and working on that work. That was his work, the work of restoration, of reconciliation. And as followers of Jesus, it just follows for me, then it means that it's our work as well.
Well, we've reached the end of our time. Much else, obviously, in the book. Urge people to go out and get it. The book is 70x7, Jesus' Path to Conflict Transformation. We've been talking with Chad Ford. You can find him on Substack, Chad Ford on Substack. It's titled The Waymaker. And he's Associate Professor of Religious Studies and on the Faculty Advisory Board of the Haravi Peace Institute at Utah State University. He also sits on the Executive Board of the Nonprofit Peace Players. Chad Ford, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on, Tom.
And thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah.